From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I was lucky enough to have seen the show up here at La Jolla Playhouse a few years back, and to see a show about conversation of the self, between the self, or the selves, and a romantic comedy, and an experimental musical, and a musical that plays with identity. We could be talking about Frozen, or we could be talking about Avenue Q. We could be talking about anything done by my guests, Kristen and Robert Lopez. Thank you guys so much for being here. The show, the TV version of Up Here, is now on Hulu. And I have to tell you, one of my favorite things was the Christmas prayer song. Not only the lines, "I hope your Christmas sucks as much as mine," but there's also a line in the song that perfectly describes the characters, as played by Mae Whitman and Carlos Valdez, when they sing, "I never plan ahead." I mean, that song so perfectly describes the two of them, doesn't it?
I mean, can any of us plan ahead for anything?
Some people do, I hear.
If you guys can, just for the audience, tell them what the show's about.
This show was always about ordinary people in modern times trying to deal with relationships. But the twist has always been that we get to see inside their heads and hear the voices plaguing them, the voices of doubt and even the voices of love and hope and inspiration that they quash. The whole idea is that there's this big musical in every one of us, honestly, all these huge feelings that we very rarely share or see. And we wanted to portray that as a musical. And that's always been, you know, in every version of Up Here, that's been what it's about.
Yeah, making it a rom-com is the thing that adds extra conflict, because there's this great quote from Elizabeth Gilbert: "The day you meet your soulmate, it's the day that you meet the person who holds a mirror up to yourself and the person who you're supposed to be." And that doesn't mean that it's easy. It means that it actually makes you sort of wake up to the ways that you want to grow and the ways that you need to grow.
Well, the theme song of the show, which is reprised in such an amazing way in the last episode, "Can I Ever Know You," really sums up what the show is about and the conflicts that the characters are dealing with.
It's all about how our consciousness hides our true feelings from one another. And Kristen and I, who have been together, for example, sometimes we look across the breakfast table and just say, "God, who the hell are you?" You know, and I think anyone in a relationship can identify with that idea. I think, and the answer is no, you can never fully know someone. But what seems so romantic to me about that is that you can spend the rest of your life trying, or, you know, learning a little bit more day by day. And that's the good thing about marriage. It gives you a purpose for the rest of your life.
I mean, the fun of it is not only are the people, for the most part, the people around them self-involved, but the voices in their heads are self-involved. And I just thought, that's the one thing that transferred from the stage show to this. This is the idea that these voices fighting for attention and demanding to be heard. And like you're saying, there are different ages in those parts of themselves, but that these voices are just so cacophonous, which is, again, the fun of the reprise at the end of the series, when that same cacophony really sort of takes flight.
I think people leave lasting impressions on us, and they live within us as parts of our psyche. And that's the wonderful thing we talk about each week in therapy, both of us. And it's the thing that we talk about every day with each other. So much of getting through our marriage has involved really making space and wanting to cross the bridge into one another's minds, honestly. And we'll never fully get there. But I know so much. I mean, ever since, you know, I realized, like, oh, it's kind of part of me, part of my job in this marriage is to take care of young Kristen. You know, what happened to young Kristen long ago? What are the wounds that she suffered and can't help but think every time something bad happens in the present? And I realize, you know, it's one of my jobs and one of my privileges to get to talk to her, like talk to that little girl that felt betrayed by her friend in fourth grade. And it's my job to remember that day and how that day might be affecting today.
It's also my job to laugh at the person who still lets the girl from fourth grade make me make decisions and realize like I am an adult of a certain age, and that 9-year-old girl who, you know, kicked me out of the group, you have no place here.
It's the treatment. We're working some things through with the creators of the Hulu series Up Here, Robert and Kristen Lopez. We know them from many, many other things. Now, one of the things I was going to say is, in so much of your work, it's about conversations people are having with themselves. I was thinking so much in watching this, do you want to build a snowman? And trying to talk to that person who's not listening to you. Or love is an open door, which is also about miscommunication. It's funny where we finish each other's sandwiches. I mean, that idea of attempting to communicate with somebody else so desperately who isn't quite hearing you is certainly a current that runs through your songs. I mean, for God's sakes, You and Me, but mostly Me. I mean, so many of the songs you've done have been about these conversations about ego trying to communicate with id.
I think one of the things that defines humanity is that we're all kind of stuck in our own consciousnesses, and all we've got are these really primitive tools of talking and using words that can have multiple meanings for multiple people. You know, what we do with our faces or our hand or our body language, like that's all we got to sort of bridge the musical that's going on in Bobby's head and the musical that's going on in my head. To get meta about it, one of the amazing things about our life is that we get to write songs together. So we get to pour a little of each of ourselves as individuals into a song that creates its own musical outside of us and hopefully communicates to the other musicals in everybody else's heads.
I guess if I could, I'd like to ask you guys about writing that song that's the theme that recurs so often in this show, because as we were saying, it does so much work. It lifts the show up in so many ways. And also the song Can I Ever Know You, in terms of the way it's performed at each point, it's about a different kind of emotional sort of peak or valley for the characters.
That phrase, can I ever know you, or I guess it was in the stage show, it was written as I can never know you. And that was always the thematic crux of the story. And it was meant to be really the low point for the main character in Act One. It was a very dirge-like, sad, full of despair. We tried to go Shostakovich, eighth string quartet with how sad we went with it. I can never know you. And then, but we made sure that the tune itself, divorced from that harmony, was simple and could be used in a happy way, because we love the idea that it's really actually a very romantic thought when you look at it from a different perspective. And so we didn't use that sad song, surprise. We based this main title on the same tune, which, it, you know, when you listen to it in the context that we've now written it, it feels like a very positive and up idea. It's a complicated idea, but there's a joy behind it, kind of a fervor that they're realizing I could enjoy spending the rest of my life trying to get to know you better, but never fully getting there. And I remember when we were writing it, we both just, it was like one of those moments where we pitied the neighbors because we were just singing it really loud over and over again and banging the piano pretty hard.
Well, let's talk about the hairy concept, not concept, but doing this thing, moving it from this thing that was really about intimacy on the stage and about us connecting with I think it was Dan, right, to changing so much about it. I mean, now it actually takes place in what feels like what would have felt like an apocalyptic moment, 1999. And that really just kind of heightens the anxiety the characters are feeling. So let's talk about all those shifts that take place in moving it from the stage to television.
We loved our team and our cast that performed it in La Jolla, but we learned a lot from that experience. One, we learned that raising two children and doing book music and lyrics of an original musical was just not sustainable for our mental health or our family. And this other thing we really learned was that what had started as, let's just stay in the male protagonist's head, became a little bit frustrating. And I think the audience was frustrated too, of like, we want to see in her head. We thought we would get enough information because she was extroverted, but it turns out that we wanted to know just as much what was driving her decisions. The thought of rewriting the whole thing to incorporate her consciousness was a bit daunting, and we had to do Frozen Broadway and Frozen 2 and Coco and several other things that were knocking at our door. So we kind of put it away for a little while. And then when the pandemic came, Tommy Cale gave us a call and said, "Hey, I'm exploring this television thing. Do you have anything for us?" And it was funny that it was Tommy Cale, because just that fall, Fosse Verdon had come out. And Bobby and I, if there's a president and vice president of the Fosse Verdon fan club, it's the two of us. We just fell in love with that series, and also fell in love with the way Stephen and Tommy had found a way to take you from the narrative through music into the protagonist's psychology. And we kind of realized they're doing what we were trying to do with Up Here, and they're doing it beautifully. So it was a no-brainer when Tommy called us in spring of 2020 that we said, you know, there's this Up Here show, and I think you're the person who knows how to do this for television. And then we instantly called Lev. I think we got him on the phone that afternoon. And that really was the key. And we brought in Danielle Sanchez-Witzel, who had done 30-minute comedies before for television, to sort of round out, if we were the Fellowship of the Ring, you know, we had the songwriters, the director, the book writer, and the TV writer.
We'll take a short break. My guests are Robert and Kristen Lopez, their new show. There's the adaptation of their stage show Up Here for Hulu. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. There's more to come. Stay with us. It's The Treatment. I'm back with people who understand what it is to deal with how our thoughts and verbal expressions differ in so many shows they've done, from Book of Mormon to Frozen to Coco to now Up Here, the adaptation of the show they did on stage. The show is on Hulu. My guests are Robert and Kristen Lopez. For Miguel's character, I mean, there's one piece that's really telling, without giving too much away, in episode 6, where he's going through the video game. That song is kind of about assimilation, because it's also about being absorbed into nerd culture. And it's also about him recognizing this part of himself that he's kind of hidden, or that he's pushed away, his artistic ideals. I mean, this idea of trying to figure out who you are, trying to repress who you are to be part, assimilated and part of the ideal American success. There's so much in that song that sort of tells who Miguel is, both writ large and writ small.
Honestly, the score of that particular piece, the 8-bit operetta that we wrote, was inspired by The Legend of Zelda, which was inspired by Ravel. Ravel's Bolero being their first choice of music for Legend of Zelda. So we tried to do our own little, you know, ninth chords in the beginning to give it that kind of French sound that works so well on Nintendo 8-bit synthesizer.
And Bobby composed an hour of 8-bit French Legend of Zelda-inspired music, by the way. If anyone wants to hear more of that from Robert Lopez, it's there. It's just waiting for the world to want it.
Well, I guess that's the world you guys haven't conquered yet, video games. But I wanted to get back to that song, too, because, yeah, that French aspect of that underscore in it. But also just that there's so much contained in that song about the idea of dealing with being assimilated, but also trying to recognize there's this thing in you that's what you want versus what you think you should do to be successful. I mean, just the sort of the push and pull of who you are versus your idea of what being an American is. There's a ton in that song.
It was one of the hardest episodes to nail down, and the writer's room was very dogged about, you know, version after version. But what it eventually settled on was the idea of being armored up, that boys, you know, early in their childhoods, for whatever reason, anything that's different about them, sensitive or weak or anything that's perceived as not aggressive, masculine, and sporty, is drummed out. So the idea that Miguel is this creative guy who became a video game designer fit neatly around the idea of maybe this song in which he thinks he's in a video game and he's being led around by a Gandalf kind of figure. And the name of the game is to find more pieces of armor so that by the time he gets all the armor and has a full suit and wins the game and he's completely, you can't even see him for all the armor he's wearing, that's when he gets the girl. And that's, you know, like in the last scene of any video game, the romantic music starts playing and you get to watch a love scene, you know, the knight rescue the princess from the castle. But Miguel, in our version, has so much armor on that he can't kiss her. He can't love her. It's all in the way and he needs to take off all the armor.
That episode is a particular favorite of mine just because the opening song is that song Falling in Love, which feels both like Katrina and the Waves and Stephen Sondheim to me.
Exactly. The Stephen Sondheim of it all being, you know, the wanting something but not doing it, like having that ambivalence where you're pulling in two completely different directions. So falling in love, but only halfway is what the whole song is about. And I have to give a big shout out to Sonia Taye, who was our choreographer, because I think that she cracked the secret to selling the dance, which was he is dancing as fast as he can. Like he's not taking a breath. He's not allowing any real feeling to come in. So he's just doing a jitterbug through this relationship, like the fastest, most exhausting jitterbug. And those poor dancers on the day we filmed it, I think we ordered pizza in from a pizza truck and they had easily burned 10,000 calories in 5 hours of filming this. And I just kept saying like, here, have more pizza, more pizza.
This being such a tricky episode to nail, we had written the first version of the song was more of a French waltz, almost like an Elliott Smith waltz. It played up the ambivalence of how he felt and you know, he was in love, but he was scared and we didn't change a note of the tune and we didn't change one chord. All we did was change the arrangement to the Katrina and the Waves beat. And somehow the song survived that. it's this bizarre Elliott Smith meets sock hop.
Let's talk too about your leads, who I was telling you before we got started. I only know Carlos Valdez from The Flash, which I think they did a musical episode once a millennium or something. And I had no idea he had those kinds of chops, but also he's just physically so different here. I mean, we can sort of see the play in his face. I mean, he's just so great at sort of hiding things and not hiding things with somebody. Well, not somebody like, but with Mae Whitman, who also I didn't know. And I know Mae, but I didn't know that she sang so well. So talk about casting those two actors in this.
Well, we can't talk about casting without really talking about Tommy, because Tommy is a master at casting. He's just brilliant, and he knows everybody, and everybody just is dying to work with him, including us. So I think he was the magnet that drew the amazing talent. Mae was the first to join. And Carlos, honestly, we didn't even know him from The Flash. You know, we had never heard of him. But someone in the writer's room thought of him, and he was oddly compelling from the very first audition. Just he knew what was funny about the song I Am Not Alone immediately. He just killed us. He brought so much sensitivity to the part. You know, we were pretty well convinced from early on. It was just a matter of making sure that, you know, you never know in terms of the chemistry between two performers when you're casting them. If you're going to get that thing that you need, that connection, that spark. So we had, you know, lots of different auditions, and then we had finally a chemistry read between the two of them, where it really became like this strange off-Broadway play. We had them, we were sitting in the middle of this room, and we had swivel chairs, and Tommy had directed them to have this argument, the one that's in the woods of episode 5, where she was walking away, and he was walking away, and she was trying to chase after him. And they just went in circles around us, and we swiveled in our chairs watching this play kind of in the round. You know, it put us right in the woods. It was incredible. And the chemistry sparked right onto the camera, and thank goodness, because that's what this needed.
It's a treat, we should say, that my guests, Chris and Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, the creators of Up Here for Hulu and before that for the stage, are talking about Thomas Kail, who directed show, and also you might know from his incredible stage work, such as In the Heights. And I guess what I was thinking too is that this thing that really works so well in this is that there's such a sense of yearning in all those songs that makes him like romantic, capital R and small R. And I want you to talk about those compositions, because sort of tonally, when you're talking about Fosse Verdon, it's about two people who couldn't communicate with each other just because they were competing with each other. And this is about people who were competing with themselves. I mean, competing with their interior selves and trying to speak to each other. So many of these songs, and we've talked about a few of them here, are about that idea of sort of fighting this part of yourself, but also fighting to get something out. And I just think that's a really remarkable emotional through line to have to wrestle with in creating songs.
At the very core of this whole story is a yearning to be known and to know someone. It's the first song. The whole opening song is a moment when the female protagonist realizes that she's created this life where she's kind of sleepwalking through it, that she's saying all the things, you know, the Hallmark ideas of how wonderful it is to know someone. She's been living with this man and working with him and has what looks like a very lovely life, but doesn't quite know herself and doesn't quite know him. She, in this moment of sort of awakening to the question of like, can you know somebody? Can you really? She ends up kind of blowing up her life. And we've such a short time on this planet, the yearning to do what you're supposed to do and find your purpose, but also to find your person is at the core of both of our main characters. I remember in the fall of 99, sort of being in a place also of stagnation, and the idea that the world was going to end on New Year's Eve kind of made me break out of that and wake up to like, what do I want? And who do I want? And take action. Because again, if the world's going to end, like there's nothing to lose. So why don't you try something? And so that leads kind of to the I Want song called What If? Like, what if you try to change this ever looping tune? What if you let them see the dark side of your moon? I certainly spend my life asking this question, like, what if? What if I grow a little bit more? Even now, I'm happily married, I'm a songwriter, but there's always, what if I take a risk and write something completely different? Will it work? I don't know, but I'll grow.
I guess that's what I'm still thinking too, because the music also sort of gets to what their home lives are like. That she basically seems to live in like a Feydeau farce when there are constantly doors opening and closing around her. And he's sort of marooned in how to succeed in business without really trying. So, I mean, even their separate existences feel very much like two different kinds of stage shows.
The part that we couldn't supply, the thing that we don't really do is story and plot. You know, we're songwriters, we want to tell the story and forward the plot and all that stuff. But when it comes to writing book, I mean, Kristen's way better than I am, but we certainly welcome the help of people that did that for a living and were experts at it. So it was fun to be a part of the writer's room as they figured out all the, you know, the Feydeau element of Lindsay's life. You know, they had to research investment banking to write Miguel's story. And I was so glad that we didn't have to do that. But it paid off. I mean, they just needed to kind of read a little bit and they realized, oh, here's what we can hang the story on.
This is a thing we should talk about too. What a rarity it is for a TV series to be musical and to not only have original songs, but also original musical numbers. When we're talking about the first episode, which moves basically almost like the five stages of death in terms of sort of the way the songs play out, to the last episode, where, as and without giving too much away, that reprise of that theme, where each of those characters in the head gets a chance to voice something and to sort of be a person in some way. It's thrilling to get a show because it's been tried in TV once a decade, and then it doesn't work, and then people run away from it. I was going to ask you if that was a fear, to have a show with this much original music and musical choreography in it.
It was a fear, but it was also on our bucket list of something to try. It was a mountain we wanted to climb, because I do think we're probably the first generation of songwriters that grew up absolutely loving TV. And raised on TV. We're Gen Xers. And you can tell, because we wrote all those songs for WandaVision, we were raised on yes. everything from I Love Lucy to Seinfeld, to The Office. And to be able to take this love of storytelling, I mean, there are three things going on in the soup of this. The love of musical storytelling. Bobby and I also grew up on cast albums and went to the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Writing Workshop to learn how to make this thing that we loved so much called a musical. And that's our life's work. But then there's also this love of TV and being funny and the 30-minute architecture. And so we were very excited to see, can you fuse the two? Because people have done it, but they've used source songs, which are pre-existing songs, or they've used the fun of making fun of musicals, you know, pastiche, making fun of showbiz. But, you know, what we tried to do with this is ask the question, can we write the kind of show or sitcom or rom-com that we would love to watch, but also make it an original musical that doesn't make fun of itself? Is that possible? And it was not easy, but with the help of Tommy Kail and Stephen Levinson, we've made something that we're really proud of.
Well, I'm so glad you guys are able to do this show. My guests are Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. They are creators, co-creators of the series Up Here. I think a remarkable achievement on Hulu. I've wanted to have you guys on the show for a long time, so it's a thrill to finally get you to do this. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Elvis.
Thank you so much for your wonderful insights and questions, and it got me excited about maybe getting to go back and work on this again, perhaps.
Our first EGOT, Robert and Kristen Anderson Lopez. For Hulu, they created the musical comedy series, Up Here. And please show us some love by making a donation to KCRW during our pledge drive. Whether it's returning champions such as Stahelski or first-timers such as the Lopez's, catch them all at kcrw.com/thetreatment. You can catch me here and there. Very Susian of me. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. And please remember, consider a pledge during our pledge drive. And anytime.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. There is a particular subgenre movie I like to call the black suit movie, be it Purple Noon or A Bittersweet Life or, of course, Reservoir Dogs or The Driver. It's a movie where basically the precision of the outfit tells you a lot about the character. And I thought about that in watching the new John Wick movie, John Wick Chapter 4, but just because the movie seems to end where it starts off. And I'm not going to say anything else for those of you who haven't heard, but the director of the films, Chaz Stahelski, is back. I can't thank you enough for doing this. And talk to me, first of all, about the way, I know you know this as well as anybody, that John Wick fits for you into the sort of the tribe of the black suit movie.
Yeah, you kind of nailed it. What's interesting about any of the black suit characters that you're talking about is the idea of transformation and duality. It's just like a superhero costume. It's a suit of armor. It's showing us that the character has a duality. He's put, you know, it's like the old Westerns where they hang up the guns and they put them back on. It's very symbolic. And I think if nothing else, we love a little bit of symbolism in John Wick. We try to make him fun and hyper real. Like, you know, it's my version of Lord of the Rings or my version of Dune. It's just instead of the future of the past, it's modern times. You know, it's Buster Keaton meets Zatoichi meets Leone meets, you know, Tarantino a little bit. If I could be so lucky as to be half as talented as any of those people. But like in the first movie, we wanted it to be like his cape. Once he put that on, it's a personality transformation. Keanu did a great job of once he puts on the suit, he stands different. He walks different. He's letting you know he's a different character at that point by putting it on. You know, on the subtext levels, you know, John's a man of precision. We say it in the first one. And just by the way we cut the suits and how he ties, you know, we like a little bit of the old world formalism there when you see him in the three-piece suit. And, you know, like you see Bill Skarsgård in the triple knot Windsor ties and all this kind of stuff. Having a sartorial awareness is kind of cool in John Wick.
We can talk a little bit about the very first scene in the very first John Wick movie, which I was thrown back to and seeing one of the climactic scenes in this movie. And I just wondered, as you guys were getting to make more and more of these films, Chad, if you thought that you wanted to make it this circle, that you wanted to make it in this way, kind of a parable.
You know, in retrospect, it seems like, oh yeah, we were pretty clever, but no, the reality is we didn't do that. We did the first one and never thought we'd direct again. So we were like, oh, we dodged a bullet. Like, you know, and then that's the city number. It wasn't really until John Wick 2 that Keanu and I sat down and go, okay, there's a world here. You know, can we really do this Greek mythological overlay and start putting in continentals in every city and the whole suspension of disbelief? What we're very aware of is how the mix of the real world and this goes. Like, we know it's supposed to be a fable. It's a campfire tale. If people aren't on board for the ride, they're like, okay, where's the cops? Why isn't anybody looking at the club? Why isn't anything like that? Like, totally get it. We're trying to sustain or suspend disbelief because it's a bit of a fantasy. It's more about, you know, Dante. It's more like Lord of the Rings. Like, okay, we know there's no orcs, but you got to get through it a little bit. You know what I mean? There's an acceptance of the world around. And as we started getting bigger, we didn't want to be restrained. Like, look, when you're dealing with sequels, you can do one of two philosophies, right? You can make the same movie over and over again and change characters. And, you know, there's some franchises that have success with that. And then there's other franchises that kind of go just bigger, better, or reinvented, or whatever you want to call it. We try to do just a little of both by being better at ourselves and expand out the world through different perspectives of characters. And that's kind of what we experimented with most as we were going through. Cut to now we're on John Wick 4, and Keanu and I are always like, okay, well, what are we going to do on this one? And it was never about how to go bigger or better. It was just like, okay, we look back at our work and we went, okay, we have three distinctly different films, you know, how do we tie them all together? And the goal with number four was to do just what you just asked, was to kind of find all the themes and tie all the threads back together again and come up with a somewhat satisfying conclusion to the previous films.
I guess I just, like I said, was thrown back to just because seeing him in that same outfit, but more or less with a stomach wound, taking his phone not to look at a video. I mean, it's just like, oh, this is kind of a perfect way to sort of answer a question.
That happened a little bit more in retrospect before or as we're editing the fourth one. You know, the first movie was a bit accidental how we edited it. It's not really edited like the script by any means. We kind of discovered the movie in the cut. Oh, no, it didn't start that way. It started without a funeral. It was a very different start. We thought it was much more interesting to have that almost surreal fever dream opening of a man, like, you know, and then tell the story backwards. Like, how did he get here? You know, that seemed to deliver a little bit more punch to us in the audience when we kind of discovered it in editing, but it definitely wasn't the original way. So then when we're editing number four, I went back and watched all the movies and go, okay, this could be cool to bookend it like that. That's how we come up with almost the matching scenes where you see John with the stomach wound and then John with the stomach wound. That was our little inside joke about how to bookend the franchise.
It's the treatment. My guest was letting all the cats out of the bags is Chad Stahelski. Of course, his new film as director is John Wick Chapter 4. But I guess as you were talking about the Warriors too, I mean, well, first of all, you mentioned Dante. You start off with Dante. I couldn't help but think about Greek mythology just because not only is there that warrior thing, By the way, I love the name of the radio station, the call letters of the radio station, which I won't give away.
Cause somebody got WXI, Wuja. That's somebody got that. That's what they'd call Chinese wire work fantasy films, Wuja films.
If you've seen The Warriors or you read the book and you know it's the Anabasis and Xenophon and the 10,000, this one really feels like that in that way.
Yeah. Whether you like the film or not, the fact that people get it and feels like, and when I mean epic, I don't mean epic to scale. It just feels like it's sprawling and feels like there's a, you know, a mythological aspect to it. Like, it's almost like, you know, the narrator's telling you what's going on with John. You know, from the beginning, we always wanted to make him like Odysseus. You know, he just wants to get home. And that was the kind of overall model for all of them. And we kept going back to Odysseus and all his trials. And we're like, okay, well, we'll follow the Joseph Campbell storytelling mode of put your character up in a tree, throw rocks at him for a couple acts and see how he gets out. Combine that with the fact that I think all characters should face dilemma, not a choice between good and bad, but a choice between bad and worse. And that's what we try to put all the characters, like every scene in John Wick 4 should have something to do with a character making a choice and never the one they want to. And that's what kind of forces the plot and the story along. I think that's what makes it interesting. But that all comes from, you know, mythological references.
The fun about these movies, what I call the black suit movies, is that they have this great ability to go both high and low. And it's also the fun of seeing characters realized through action rather than dialogue.
Yeah. When I say I like silent films, it's not like I watch, like I actually like them. I study them. I love nonverbal communication. And I think Keanu and I are both fascinated, like how much you can say with a look or gestures or body language or with etiquette or with style. You know, again, you hear the stories of Keanu and I writing these big lists of what we love about action movies, what we don't love about action movies. And over exposition is one of the things we don't really care for. Like, you shouldn't have to tell the audience how somebody feels. Like, there's, like, look at Bill Skarsgård with just a look of an eye or a gesture. Keanu can say, yeah, you know, 20 different ways. You know what I mean? That's the cool part about it. It's just always interesting to see how you get things across without over-explaining things. And I think, again, from myth or fables, the audience has to read into it. Like, we want it participatory. So if I give you John's full backstory in any one scene, it kind of takes the fun away a little bit. Like, I like dropping the little hints and like having each member of the audience figure out where he's from. You know, the clues are all there, but like, you know, was he special forces? Was he a Marine? Was he an assassin? What martial arts style did he study? You start seeing these little pieces in every movie, but we never give you the full picture. And I think that's important in the scenes too, to kind of get what we're trying to say across a little bit and how to keep the story moving, but at the same time, leave a little room for everybody to interpret their own thing about it. And I think nonverbal communication is very, very key to that. I think it's underutilized in most films.
Well, it's funny because we talked about comedy and silent comedy the last time you were here. And one of the things about silent comedy that relates to John Wick stuff, especially this last movie, is that you realize in watching Buster Keaton or Harold Lloyd or even Chaplin, how much of that comedy is basically on the precipice of jeopardy. And that's really where it comes in here, isn't it?
The art of the gag. It's a great little special on Buster Keaton about the setup and the style and how you get your character beloved before you throw him down 200 stairs. I think that's when you're doing something like John Wick, we're already hyper real in the world and we're already mythological in the world. And we're always doing, you know, extreme action under extreme, you know, suspension of disbelief, you know, to the critics and to the people that don't get it. Like we're in on the joke, believe me. Like, that's why we're doing these movies. We love them. We're in on the gag. And I think the comedy helps hopefully let the audience know, like, we're with you. We're part of the, like, we're having fun. We're messing with you. You know, we want you to know, like, everyone in the movie is taking it seriously, but the filmmakers and the filmmaking team, we get that it's a gag. Like, we're trying to build him up. He literally is a Greek fable of Odysseus. You know, we're trying to get him up. And the staircase in this matter is a direct ode to Buster Keaton and all that Buster Keaton embodies in like a metaphor. It's Sisyphus, right? It's roll the boulder to the top just to get knocked back down, but do it in a fun and interesting way that hopefully tells you a little bit of the story. I need to get John to the top of those stairs so I can knock him down so we can team up with Kane, so they can have their bonding moment before they go duel with each other. You know, so that's the overarching story theme of it.
But it's also, too, I mean, you're talking about sort of sartorial representation. And part of that, too, is that these guys are wearing two different kinds of black suits. The ties are actually knotted in two different ways, a Windsor knot versus a four in hand. One is really almost classically, like, in some shots, Donnie Yen almost looks like Roy Orbison in a suit. But also, it's too about, and certainly brings to mind the John Woo films of the 80s and 90s, but also it's kind of about how we realize that these are different people just in the way they move in the fight. And that's been also another kind of through line in the movies, that every battle is about John versus somebody else and these warring styles. So that becomes too a part of the physical expressiveness that tells us who people are rather than explaining, like you were saying, well, I do this style and I'm from here. It's better to show rather than to have somebody explain it.
That's always the mantra on John Wick, show, don't tell. But again, like, people ask me, well, why, you know, obviously we got the script from Derek Colstead on the first one. I had a dog in it. My partner at the time, Dave Leach, and I turned into a puppy. We're both dog people. We grew up with dogs our whole lives. If you want to see a different side of anybody, from the most badass person you know to the most emotional person you know, you see different sides of people when you see them around animals. Animals are the perfect reflecting surface to reveal character. So if you have a really badass assassin who is stoic to say the least, how do you get the audience on board with them? Well, in our mind, we gave them a puppy and we showed them a reaction to something so innocent and simple. The point I'm making is it's a way to reflect a different part of his character without John Wick actually saying, I love people, I'm a nice guy. You know, that's a hard one to pull off. And a lot of action movies try to do that with a love interest or, you know, a cause or something. This, once John Wick feeds that puppy a bowl of cereal, you're in. You don't have to act like, I didn't have to write anything. It was a gesture. And when he licks Keanu's face, you're like, okay, I'm in. Like, I get a side of this guy. Like, he's not just an assassin. So if you take that same theory or mentality to action, it's like, how am I going to show you different sides of this character without, you know, having different reflective surfaces? And we call reflective surfaces different martial arts styles, different characters. Keanu fights very differently with Donnie Yen, very differently with Scott Atkins, very differently with Hiroyuki Sanada, very differently with our different stunt teams. We keep changing styles and opponents and set pieces. So you always see something about John, whether that's his cunning, his fortitude, his toughness, or his inventiveness. That's what keeps it interesting, right? We call it the lot of a little strategy. We want you to see different sides of John, but in order to do that, it's not just John doing them, it's giving him reflective surfaces or an obstacle or a dilemma or a choice that allows him to show a different side than he showed in the previous sequence.
By the way, it's the treatment, our guest is somebody who's become an old friend of the show, Chaz Stahelski. His new film, of course, I think you've heard of it, is John Wick Chapter 4. I think what's interesting, too, is that all these things we're talking about, right down to, for me, the idea of making the camera movement, and we talked about this last time, too, as formal as possible. So it feels like there's weight in this, that even though we're talking about stuff, you're making movies about things that are not exactly connected to the real world, it has the weight of the real world. And I think that kind of thing and the size of these rooms and these artifacts that predate everybody, there's the sense of history. So nothing seems new, finally. It all seems like it's these things that have been passed down either in the rituals that people go through or the artifacts they're surrounded with. There's a lot of deliberation in this stuff.
Thank you. That's really nice when people notice it. So it's just like, look, we know we're making this kind of fun, you know, hyper-real action movie, but like, you know, the craftsmanship behind it, with Kevin Cavanaugh, my production designer, and Dan Lawson, my cinematographer, do my stunt team. They're aesthetics that I always enjoy in life. I love the old and the new. I love going to obviously I have museum fetishes. I mean, I spent, you know, God knows, 12 years with the Wachowski. So it's like Wachowski film school, but like their attention to detail and what you say with the background, the set, the wardrobe, the hair and makeup styles. Like, look at Rina Sawayama. It looks like she jumped out of a Japanese anime. You know, Keanu's jumping out of a manga. You know, the set pieces are right out of a modern art piece. You know, that's, you know, our lighting is as extreme as I think you can get with highlights and contrast. It's like a Wong Kar Wai film on steroids. We try to create all that stuff very deliberately. So it kind of takes you out of the existing world, kind of puts you in that headspace that, wow, I'm in a different dimension. I'm in a different realm. The believability of the action kind of holds up. A lot of the design work is that juxtaposition between old and new. And then the camera work, to your point, is meant to show off geography. It's meant to, you know, John's supposed to be this Greek myth, right? He's supposed to be in the world of the gods. He's supposed to be an adult. He's supposed to be a little man in the world of deities. So that's why we use the big anamorphic lenses and these very studio-related camera moves. Again, like if you go back and watch like a great thing like Singing in the Rain with Gene Kelly, you know, if you go watch that famous dance sequence when he's actually singing in the rain, the camera work is very minimal. It's on a giraffe pan and a dolly. You're just enjoying the performer perform. There's no fast editing. There's no camera tricks. There's no, you know, insane camera angles or moves. It's just letting the audience just soak up Gene Kelly. You can do that because you have Gene Kelly and he's got that charisma that's going. I have Keanu Reeves. He's my Gene Kelly. You know, he can do the 50 move fight scenes. We can do these camera moves that highlight what we have, which is like the Sacré-Cœur steps. We have the Louvre. We have the Eiffel Tower. We have these great, amazing set pieces that we spent time in. That's really putting the audience in. I'm a big live show guy. Like, I love going to theater. I love going to dance performances and soaking that up. And it's funny how your eye works here, right? You sit in the center of the stage, you see everything. Then the one ballerina comes out, you focus on her. Then the troupe comes out and you kind of almost widen back with your eyesight and your peripheral. And that's all we're doing. And that pulls you into the performance. We're trying to do that on film. We're trying to pull everyone into the performance. And when we pop into a close-up, I want his head 40 feet big on that screen. So you're paying attention to what this guy is doing. It's not this random selection of close-ups, mediums, and wides. I want to soak you in through the wides and the mediums. So when I do use a close-up, you know, we're trying to say something.
It's funny you bring up Singing in the Rain, because as he's tumbling down the steps, I find myself thinking of make him laugh.
Yeah, you know? Of course.
And the deliberation in that, and just like going up the hill and trying to keep this thing in motion. And again, I use this word. There's an elegance that brings to mind that I think the best of the Black Suit movies have in common, but also that takes us certainly back to Leone, who took his time and took lots of time with really big frames. And when he went spherical with the lenses, you knew he's trying to make a point about faces the same way that you tend to do with these films. And there is this really fascinating intersection for me between the old world and the new world. But also you're saying that I know audiences have patience, that if we just wait and give them a moment rather than force things on them, they will respond, which is, again, what Purple Noon does. It's what The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly does. It's what Once Upon a Time in the West does. It's what even A Bittersweet Life does. They're not rushing it. And also, and all these things have in common, is the hero who won't be rushed.
Look, just in the reviews, I get like, you know, if my worst review, if my most negative review is the runtime feels bloated. I'm like, so let me get this straight. You like the movie and it's too long, but why do you think you like the movie? You know, like, okay, you love the action in it. You love the pacing. You love the scale. You love the feeling. I mean, why do you have that feeling? Well, that feeling is because we give it space. You know, I just absolutely detest the runtime critique. I actually, the movie is what the movie is. It is what it is. You can argue the Batman's, the Way of Waters, or the John Wick 4s are too long or too not, but like they all make you feel something. What people don't, it's a synergistic effect of everything. It's not like, hey man, let's just cut a scene and we'll make it 20 seconds shorter. Like, okay, any critique out there that says we're too long, okay, go, okay, get off your ass. Let's take you to an Avid editing board and go ahead, cut it your way. You see what you can take out. And when you start trimming all the wides and you keep trimming the pauses in between dialogue, and you go ahead, you trim that thing down 10 minutes. Dare you. Go ahead and see if it gives you the same feeling. People don't get that, like the magic of editing or magic of those pauses. Like any great piece of music, it's not about the notes. It's the space in between the notes. Like notes are notes. It's the pauses and the stops that make the notes come to life and give you melody. That's the same thing with editing. I mean, if I took out all the pauses, Bill Skarsgård would be out of the movie. Like Bill's all about those looks. Can't be out of the movie. If I just cut to overs and because he's like, I keep cutting back to him because I want you to see what he's feeling. All those little breathy shots and those establishing shots give the movie scale and breath, and it lets you embrace what's going on. It's like a live show. So when you start talking about airing things out and letting everything breathe, that's what gives you that feeling of immersion. When you start going too fast, people never, like I've gone back and put little beats in action because you didn't have time to relish in what it was just done. Jackie's great at this. Oh, Kung Fu movies are great. They'll actually hit the pose afterwards. They'll do wah, 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 something cool. And then they hit a pose. They're not just hitting the pose. They're hitting the pose to let it absorb what they just did and for you to applause. You go, yeah, that was awesome. Okay, now bring me the next. If it's just an onslaught of images and dialogue and nonstop, that's not how life works. That's not allowing the audience to enjoy what you've already done. That's just hurried up to get done because you think runtime matters to the, like, look, if you go to a movie thinking, I wonder what the runtime, like, you shouldn't be going to the movies, man. Like, what, you're going to stay home and binge 12 hours of Game of Thrones, but you're not going to sit and enjoy something that you actually enjoy, then you got to rip it apart. Like, I never understood this with critics and runtimes. Like, what this, if you got better things to do, stay home and do them. Otherwise, shut up and watch the movie. I mean, like, that's what the filmmakers are really trying to do. You're going for an other world experience. Like, I didn't know there was a stopwatch on it, but there's a reason we do that. It's not just to bloat things or to show shots off. It's to give that feeling of immersion.
Well, as we're talking about this, I guess I want us to end up where we started when we first talked last time, which is the first thing I said to you is I think what makes the first movie work as much as anything, and it's something you continue to apply, is impact players, be it somebody who has one scene or one line, or somebody who, like Donnie Yen, is a presence throughout the entire film. And I can't help but bring this back to you talking about somebody who took his time and was also an impact player. I can't let you go without talking about Lance Reddick.
Obviously, and I don't know if most people know, but Lance is one of the first people, if not the first. I mean, Keanu ended up hiring Dave and I to direct. Like, he was attached before we were on the original John Wick. And Keanu does the solid of giving us the opportunity to direct. But I think after that, I think Lance may have been the first character cast member that we hired on the first John Wick. And you know, I always tell the story that when you go back and, you know, in hindsight, oh, it was great. But on the day, it was, you know, an 80 or so page script based on a retired assassin that comes out of retirement and kills 80 people because they kill his puppy. You know, that's not an easy sell, you know, to cast or to ever. So, you know, we finally, or most studios in town hadn't been that interested in doing it. So we did it independently. And then we go to cast members and we got to get the same pitch. Lance was the first guy we go to, and we gave him the pitch, and Lance didn't miss a beat. He was just, nope, sounds great. I get it. Greek myth. I'm in. I'm going to have an African accent. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be this Zen master. And the whole time, he came up with his backstory, like literally at the lunch table. We're like, oh my God, Lance is it. And Lance has been part of the DNA ever since. I'm sure you've heard plenty of things or read plenty of things about him. Lance is a gentleman's gentleman. He's a great man, a great artist. But, you know, all that aside, or you know, you get asked about any one memory, and it wasn't really about that with Lance. He loved the work as anybody, but you know, you couldn't get him off set. Like once he was on set, he has a smile that would brighten the room, and he has a very, very positive personality. So when he's on set, like professionals can be, but my God, like just so happy to be there. Talk to everybody. If you're ever having a bad day, just go hang out with him and Ian McShane, just bantering behind the camera. It was, I can't even tell you how much he loved to work and how infectious his personality is. I don't know, just the positivity was enormous. I can't say enough good things about it.
You've done so much other stuff, but I can't thank you enough for doing this chat. It means so much to me that you came back to the show again. Thank you.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
John Wick Chapter 4 is still in theaters. Its director is Chaz Stahelski. And past episodes of The Treatment can still be heard at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Oscar-winning writer-director Martin McDonagh on the film he watches every time he starts to work.
I'm Martin McDonagh, and this is The Treat. One of my favorite pieces of cinema ever, I think, is a movie called Badlands, directed by Terrence Malick in, I think, 1973. I've loved it since I was, I think, 13 or 14 years old. I loved acting up until that point, and I liked Martin Sheen, I think, even before this movie. But this was the first time that I realized, especially what a writer-director does, that he or she chooses the music, which in this film is based on a lot of classical pieces, found pieces, but also design and, of course, acting.
What's your name? I said mine.
Holly.
Well, listen, Holly. You, I don't know, want to take a walk with me?
What for?
Oh, I got some stuff to say. Guess I'm kind of lucky that way.
The two performances in Badlands are by Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek are so memorable. But also the idea of narration as a piece of art in a movie.
My mother died of pneumonia when I was just a kid. My father had kept their wedding cake in the freezer for 10 whole years. After the funeral, he gave it to the yard man. He tried to act cheerful, but he could never be consoled by the little stranger he found in his house.
He does it again in his later film, Days of Heaven, when Linda Manns narrates in a very strange, almost childlike way, the story. But in this one, the writing is impeccable. Sissy Spacek's narration, from almost like she's just reading out of a teen magazine, as a overview of a horrible story that was based on a real life killing spree. But none of you listen to the words of that's coming out of Sissy Spacek's mouth and out of Terrence Malick's, because she almost doesn't see or understand what the hell is going on in the piece.
We had our bad moments, like any couple. Kid accused me of only being along for the ride, while at times I wish he'd fall in the river and drown so I could watch.
It's one of those movies I watch every probably like 6 months every year, definitely before I make one. And every time it just pulls me in. You know, the story is horrible and it shouldn't be as romantic and beautiful as it is, but it's mesmerizing. So the combination of all those things, acting and music and cinematography and the weirdness of a piece of narration, I think it's probably one of the first times that I got what a proper master director does.
Writer-director Terrence Malick's 1973 directorial debut, Badlands, is the treat from writer-director Martin McDonagh. Check out other awards winners and nominees at kcrw.com/FYC. And find editions of the treat, such as writer-director Elegance Bratton's, at kcrw.com/the treat. The treat features notable figures from television, film, music, and sports who share intimate stories about the cultural influences that have sparked their creativity, inspired their craft, and have shaped the path of their lives. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the show. Mixed this week by Katie Gilchrist. Help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.